yesterday evening, we had a nice discussion with a group of Spanish-speaking people. Actually, it was only a few, but it was dedicated to them. It was reading from the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. He was one of the persons said in Spanish that he had read two chapters of Bhagavad Gita. And that's a big adventure, reading Bhagavad Gita for the first time. Those of you that are born in India, maybe it's a little difficult to relate to that. But for those of us that have not been born in India and couldn't even pronounce Bhagavad Gita when we first received one, to read Bhagavad Gita first time was good. It was a great adventure. So I thought to continue from where we left off yesterday, because the section of Bhagavad Gita we're reading from is relevant to anybody, and try to make it a little bit relevant to what many of you are engaged in, your professional studies or work here. Maybe we'll do this with on Saturday evening. I'm with the children. We're having the children's program, and you know, and big children too. But something that I was thinking to begin with, we're going to narrate a pastime of Krishna, something in Vrindavan. Or maybe something out of Vrindavan, or pastimes of Krishna. But to begin with, I was thinking there's a little 4-minute little video clip somebody put together that says, did you know, and then it gives all these statistics. And in short, one of the things that the statistics show is the world that we're in is so rapidly changing. Things like the number of electronic devices that had been purchased in the year, 15 years ago and 5 years ago and 3 years ago, and the number of text messages sent in the world today exceeds the world's population every day. And think of all the people that don't live where there's text messaging. The people that are enrolled in universities today, by the second and a half year that they've completed their studies, the knowledge that they've gained is outdated for finding jobs. Then another statistic that people that come out of the universities today, they will experience in an average of having something like 3.5 jobs every 5 years. And on. Here's an interesting one. The number of honors. Could you sit down?
Thank you.
The number of honors students from India today exceeds the number of students in America. Yay! Yay, India! And the number of English speak, could you? The number of English speaking people in China exceeds the American population. And on and on and on. And the world is changing so rapidly. Rapidly. And where are we? What's next? I imagine when some of you, particularly those of you that are connected with this whole medical complex, when you started off with your studies as a young man or woman, what you had in your mind of what you'd be doing today is very different than what you're doing today. And what you're doing today is likely going to be very different than what you think you're going to be doing until you complete. It's just changing and changing and changing and changing. Fortunately, there's some things that are unchanging. And the spirit soul is, by principle, unchanging. It's one of the characteristics that Krishna speaks of. And that is in contrast with whatever is of this world. Because whatever is of this world, it's vikarams is the Sanskrit term. It's the intermingling of different elements, and the elements are continually changing and changing and changing. And by the mixing of different things, you get different appearances of things. And so the modes of nature, from the Bhagavad Gita perspective, the modes of nature are operating. And the laws of karma are operating. And the configuration of things keeps changing and changing and changing. But there's something that's unchanging. And that something that's unchanging not only is the soul, but principles of how to move from this very complex situation in which we find ourselves, those principles don't change. In other words, as rapidly changing as the world is today, the principles of Bhagavad Gita are 100% applicable that they were 5,000 years ago. So here's a nice question. How old is Bhagavad Gita? I just gave it 5,000 years old. But within the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna speaks that the knowledge that he presented to Arjuna was spoken long, long ago. So long ago that Arjuna doubts, what are you talking about? You spoke this science to the sun god Vivaswan? But Vivaswan is senior to both of us. The sun god Vivaswan. And then Vivaswan to his son Vaivasvatamanu, and Vaivasvatamanu to his son Ikshvaku. And Ikshvaku brought that knowledge from the Surya dynasty to the earth planet and presented it in the Ikshvaku dynasty, in which Ramchandra appears, the sun dynasty. So Arjuna said, how is it possible that you're speaking like this? And Krishna said, no, you were there too. But I can remember, you cannot. And the reason Krishna can remember and Arjuna cannot has to do with Krishna's form being spiritual, not material. When you have a material form, you forget, because you may be conscious to some degree of what's going on at the moment. The air conditioner is on, there's this nice fan here, and light, and here we are in the room in downtown Houston. And that's a sense impression that's, you know, where we are today. But what was going on, let's say, I don't know, 48 hours ago? Where were we? We have to, let's see. 48 hours ago, let's see. Or what you, when you were a child. Why we can't remember those things so well? Why is it the memory fade? The explanation given from the Vedic perspective is because of strong identification with the body changes, and now we're focused on this and forget that. But if your body isn't material, the body, like Krishna's body, is fully spiritual, he doesn't forget. He's in the moment. Every moment, because his body is eternal. He's fully conscious. And we're not fully conscious, we're very tiny, and we're in body. So someone could show you a little baby picture, and you go, that was me? We may even remember something. Prabhupada described, he remembers things from when he was 3 years old. But the body is gone. There may be some faint memory, and what about before then, before then, before then, before then? Some people have the capacity to remember before this lifetime. But those statistics show commonly that's in childhood, and after childhood it fades. Even if they have past life remembrance, commonly it fades. Because the body is ever changing. But if we could get to the spiritual plane of consciousness, as Krishna is on the spiritual plane of consciousness, there's no forgetting. So how old is Bhagavad Gita? It's 5,000 years old, but 2 million years prior to that. Is that the number? Here we go. $120,400,000 years. At least the Bhagavad Gita was spoken by Krishna 120,400,000 years prior to his speaking it to Arjuna. So that's, and that's calculated by, if Krishna spoke it to Vivaswan, and then the duration of the rule of this present Manu, how many yuga cycles have come to before Krishna made his appearance? Anyway, you do the math and it comes out to 120,400,000. And not only is 120,400,000 years old, but it's as old as Krishna is, which is eternal. That's how old the Bhagavad Gita is. So it's appropriate, regardless of the changing of times. That's the whole point. It's unchanging. It's as appropriate today as 5,000, as 120 million, as before creation or at the beginning of creation or any time during cosmic manifestation. Because it's a science of the soul. In the discussion that we had yesterday evening, then explanation is given in the commentary of the plight, the circumstance, the challenge that we find ourselves in. Briefly, we're spirit, and we find ourselves in this ocean of the material energy. It's foreign to us. It's not natural. The spiritual atmosphere is natural to us. Being in this, everywhere you look is the material energy place, it's unnatural for us. And we're uncomfortable, trying to be comfortable in a place that's by design. Dukkhalayam ashashvatam. It's by design, it's uncomfortable. It's the place of dukkha. And it's purposeful that it's like that. It goes like this. A living entity has a relationship with the personality of Godhead eternally. The soul is part of the Supreme Soul, like a spark is unto a fire. But if that because the Supreme has all qualities in full, the part, little spark, has qualities like the full, the Supreme, but very tiny. So the Supreme is a conscious being, so we're conscious beings. The Supreme has all joy. We have the capacity of joy to some extent. The Supreme is all knowledge. We have the capacity for knowledge to some extent. The Supreme has unlimited free will. We have free will, to some extent. But we don't have the same free will as the Supreme. And because we have free will means we can use it this way, we can use it that way. And One of the ways to use free will is in harmony with the Supreme. But there's another option on the menu, and that is not in harmony with the Supreme. And when the living entity uses their free will, going away from their natural relationship with the Supreme, it's like a spark that goes away from the fire. The glowing capacity of the spark within the fire is as fiery as the fire. But that spark, when it goes away from the fire, depends on where it lands. If it lands on dry leaves, it'll make another fire. If it lands on the earth, it'll glow for some time and then diminish. If it lands in water, at once it's just a piece of carbon floating in the water. Similarly, what it is that the soul comes in contact with, the mode of nature that the soul comes in contact with, is going to determine a more luminous, less luminous, or very covered condition. And thus, the modes of nature are providing various coverings. In ignorance, a little above that in passion, a little above that in goodness, but still, even in goodness, a covering of the soul. So the discussion yesterday was the process, very simplified description of the process of creation from the Vedic perspective, is the personality of Godhead is complete. Maybe some of you know the Ishopanishad invocation. Om Purnam Adak Purnam Idam Purnat Purnam Udachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Purnam is repeated again and again. Purnam means complete. So the complete whole expands as so many complete units. And the complete whole is so complete that although so many complete units emanate from that complete whole, the complete whole isn't reduced. It's called transcendental math. 1 - 1 = 1. Very special math. Not something material. 1 - 1 = 0. But spiritual perspective, this complete whole, the Supreme One, expands so many expansions of so many varieties, material energy, spiritual energy, personal expansions, unlimited. Ramadi Murti Shukala Niyamena Tishtan Na Na Vataram Aparod Bhuvanesha Kintu. The Brahma Samhita describes so many, unlimited, of various forms. But that original is not reduced. Original remains original. And there isn't something material that's like that. However big something is, you take away some part of that big, it's that much less. But that's not... The origin of everything is so big, you can take so many units and it's not reduced. It's spiritual. Not, you can't measure it with something and estimate it and enter into that understanding with the intellect. It's just, there's no entrance. You don't have the security code. You can't go there. So the Supreme, we heard yesterday from the previous verse of what I'm going to read this evening, sees in the distance a cloud of the material energy. It's called Chaya Devi or Pradhan. Chaya Devi is, Chaya means reflection. So the Supreme Lord is with his internal potency, and the reflection of his internal potency is Chaya Devi. And he sees her wanting to have something to do, and she has nothing to do. So he gives her something to do. he glances. And his glance is very powerful, just like he is. With his glance, all the living entities that from the unmanifest state are carried, along with very important element of time. Kala. Time. And the time energy and the living entities mix with this material nature, Prakriti, or Chaya Devi, and then the elements start to separate out because they were undifferentiated before, but they're there, they're just merged in an unmanifest state. They start to manifest out one by one by one. Fast forward, living entities now with this desire to enjoy independently, because remember there's free will. I can enjoy in relation to the Supreme, and that's the spiritual world. We can also exercise our free will to say, I want to enjoy independently. And the advice that we're given is, that's not possible. And we're like little children. I want to enjoy. It's not, you can't enjoy independently. I want to enjoy. All right. I don't advise it. Here it is. It's illusion. I want to enjoy. Okay. Here it is. The illusory energy. And here's some senses. You can take those senses over to those sense objects, these senses to those sense objects, and try to enjoy. You know what you're going to get? You're going to get dukkha. You're not going to get sukha. I want to enjoy. Okay. Here it is. Here's a sandbox. You can go build a sandcastle. Go ahead. And we build our little kingdom of trying to enjoy. And that's what's described by, I'm elaborating a bit, but Krishna is describing to Arjuna, that's the circumstance. The living entity, because the beginning part of chapter 2 is Sankhya, analyzing matter and spirit and making it very clear, we're in the category of spirit. We're not in the category of matter. Now what do you do with that information? The next step is to act in the reality of we're spirit. You act in the spiritual nature, the spiritual energy. Going ahead in Bhagavad Gita, Mahatmanas Tamam Parata Daivim Prakritam Ashruta. The Maha Atma, the great soul, Daivim Prakritim Ashruta, takes shelter of the spiritual energy. And what do you do in the spiritual energy? You do things, the soul is active, but you do things pleasing the Supreme, or using the indriyas, using the senses, in service to the master of the senses. You serve God. But practical, graphic terms, senses used in service of the master of the senses. So there's this Prakriti field, material nature, call it Houston, Texas, or wherever you happen to be, and there's different things, manifestations. In your professional field, there's the medical field, particularly a number of you are. There's material nature, and it's operating, and sometimes it's breaking down, and you learn the art of how, the science of how to, the push and pull of what makes things go the way they go, and break down when they break down. But to do those things in the consciousness of this is a service to God makes all the difference between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness, or being entangled in the complexities of karma and being karma free, acting in such a way that not only you're doing your medical practice nicely or whatever your profession is nicely, but there's not, on the negative side, there's not bondage to the karma of your work. On the positive side, The natural consciousness of the soul awakens, and the capacity to understand my relationship with the Supreme Soul again. That's the spiritual energy. And Krishna, in this second part of chapter 2, describes that. He calls it buddhi yoga. And buddhi means spiritual intelligence. We were discussing this yesterday evening. There's a difference between material intelligence and spiritual intelligence. Keep it real simple. Material intelligence is how to use my senses to get sense gratification. It's called university education. Because you need material intelligence in order to, you know, to get this together with that so that you can make a product, the push and pull of material nature, so that you can get something that brings sense gratification, you got a job. Technology, you become an engineer. Or whatever it is that you... The examples that I gave yesterday evening were a cat getting the milk from the milk table, or from the kitchen table. Or you take anything that happens in material nature. I remember vividly one time I was in, as a brahmachari, traveling, distributing books. We spent the evening at a state park. It was really nice, very peaceful. And just as the sun was setting, there was a flock of geese flying, heading north because it was the springtime. It was, you know, just really nice to see at the end of a very warm day, nice cool breeze, and there's this flying in a V going quack, 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 quack. And I was thinking, where did they learn that? They didn't go to geese school and learn how to quack and fly in a V formation and fly north in the spring and fly south in the fall. But they somehow know how to do it. And there was a stream, and this, you know, the salmon swinging up the stream to lay their eggs, and then they go back down again. I don't know this as a fact, but one of our devotees that lives in California, he said that when the engineers that were planning the San Francisco Bay Bridge, for 10 years, they studied spider webs and use the technology that are used by spiders to build the Bay Bridge. I don't know. But, you know, they didn't go to spider school to learn how to build spider webs. But it takes intelligence. So, that's material intelligence, how to find a V formation, or how to build a spider web, or how to, you know, do it in a sophisticated way. Something, build a Bay Bridge, or build a skyscraper building, or whatever it is that one's occupation is. Take some intelligence to do it. Even if your intelligence is you're a thief, take some intelligence to do it. Where does that intelligence come from? It comes from Super Soul. But there's another kind of intelligence that also comes from Super Soul, and that's spiritual intelligence. The difference is with spiritual intelligence, how to use your senses in service to Krishna. It may be the same activity. Same activity. But the intelligence to do that in service to the master of the senses. Where, you know, where did this body come from? Under what principle? What governs when the machine works and it doesn't work? There may be some rules that from your medical science you study and you learn, the push and pull. This works well, that breaks down. Okay. Who set the rules? And who maintains the rules? Who blows the whistle when you break the rules? Who's the controller of this material nature? To use the senses in service to that person, to that intelligent being. That's Bodhi Yoga. And that's all of that's just a little background to cover the verse I wanted to cover. It's just short. Here's the verse, text 40 from chapter 2. Those of you that know Bhagavad Gita well, you probably recognize this verse. Nihava kramana shosti pratyavayo nivijate svalpam apiyasya dharmasya. What's the last line? Trayate mahato vaya. Nihava kramana shosti pratyavayo nivijate svalpam. Svalpa means a little. Alpa. Sa alpa. Svalpam apiyasya dharmasya. Even a little bit of devotional service. Trayate. Delivers one from Mahabhaya, the greatest fear. So here's the translation. In this endeavor, there is no loss or diminution, and a little advancement on this path can protect one from the most dangerous type of fear. We'll come back to what that most dangerous type of fear is. Purport. Activity in Krishna consciousness, or acting for the benefit of Krishna without expectation of sense gratification, Bodhi Yoga, is the highest transcendental quality of work. Even a small beginning of such activity finds no impediment, nor can that small beginning be lost at any stage. Any work begun on the material plane has to be completed, otherwise the whole attempt becomes a failure. But any work begun in Krishna consciousness has a permanent effect, even though not finished. He explains, the performer of such work is therefore not at a loss, even if his work in Krishna consciousness is incomplete. 1% done in Krishna consciousness bears permanent results, so that the next beginning is from the point of 2%. Whereas, in material activity, without 100% success, there is no profit. Ajamiva performed his duty in some percentage of Krishna consciousness, but the result he enjoyed at the end was 100% by the grace of the Lord. He gives another verse from the Bhagavatam. If someone, Chaptvad, Swadharmam charanam bhujam harir. Rest of the verse. If someone gives up his occupational duties and works in Krishna consciousness and then falls down on account of not completing his work, what is the loss on his part, and what can one gain if one performs his material activities perfectly? Or, as the Christians say, what profiteth a man if he gain the whole world if he suffers the loss of his eternal soul? Last paragraph. Material activities and their results end with the body, but work in Krishna consciousness carries a person again to Krishna consciousness, even after the loss of the body. At least one is sure to have a chance in the next life of being born again as a human being, either in the family of a great cultured Brahmana or in a rich aristocratic family that will give one further chance for elevation. That is the unique quality of work done in Krishna consciousness. Is anyone here not familiar with the Ajamila story found in the Bhagavatam? Do you know who is Ajamila? You heard? Okay, so, 6th canto Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami explains this historical incident in a place called Kanyakubja, or Kanauj, which is near Kanpur. It's a historical incident. It took place. And he narrates there was a young man, Brahmana, named Ajamila. He was properly trained, he was very qualified, he was married, he had everything, and he was very respected by everybody. So one day in service to his teacher, he went to the forest to gather materials for a yajna. He knew where to get all the ingredients, the flowers, and the wood, and the everything. So as he was going through the forest path, he saw in the forest a drunken couple. You know, we find that stuff going on all the time, but he hadn't seen such things. And And it was a prostitute and a Shudra, and part of her body was exposed, and they were, you know, doing their thing. So he was stunned. He was watching, and his mind became fixated. Then he left. So he went back to his house. He tried all his Brahminical things, chanted his mantras, studied his scriptures, did his pujas, and his mind was still on the prostitute and the scene that he saw, the impression in his mind. Couldn't get her out of his mind. So he went back and visited the prostitute and used his wealth from the dowry that came from his marriage and bought fine things for the prostitute and associated with the prostitute. And eventually he brought the prostitute right into his house, and his wife left, and he became fallen from a very qualified position to a very fallen position. And because he was a brahmana, that was his occupation, was Brahminical activity. He wasn't trained to, you know, to be an engineer or a doctor. So he didn't know what to do to maintain this new family here. So he started stealing. And he became, you know, a very, very criminal, a very fallen person from a very elevated person. And he cohabited with this prostitute for the rest of his life. And when he was very elderly, he had 10 children. And one of them was a small boy that super soul from within his heart prompted him to name his son Narayana. So his time of death came, and the Mahabhaya scene unfolded. Mahabhaya, Prabhupada explains this. Bhaya means fear, and Mahabhaya is the most fearful, or the greatest fear. And Mahabhaya is to see the Yamadutas, because that means, besides that they're very fierce looking, it means one is going to be taken to the court of Yamaraj and go to the hellish planets for one's sinful activities. So the Yamadutas came to take him at the time of death. And he saw the Yamadutas and he screamed. I won't scream. Narayana! Narayana! He was calling his son, a little toddler. Because he was attached, so where the mind is attached to at the time of death, that's where the mind goes. That's the experience of those that have survived. That's what happens, the mind goes. And wherever the mind goes, Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that state you will attain without fail. Like Bharat Maharaj. He was a great king. Great king, great personality. But he became attached to a deer. When he died, he thought of his deer, and he became a deer. Yom yom vapi smaran bhavam. Whatever you remember, that's mind carried you to that destination. Because that's what the Yamadutas are subtle. Just as we have a gross body, and we have a subtle body. So the subtle body carries the soul from the gross body. Say it again. Subtle body carries the soul from the gross body to the next body, the next mother of the next whoever, whatever the destination is. And it's not guaranteed a human form. It can be a deer, as with Bharat Maharaj, or a spider, or a human, or a demigod, or... You have a question?
You said that at the time of death, he imagines that he was a deer?
No, I didn't say that. Bharat, I'm going through a few different stories, but Bharat was a king. You've heard his name before?
Yeah.
King Bharat? So, he became attached. He was living in the forest, and a female deer gave birth to a baby fawn, but when she gave birth, it was a lion that was roaring. And she jumped in fear into the river and was swept downstream and drowned. But when she jumped, hearing the scream of the roar of a lion. There was a miscarriage. The child, the baby fawn, was born. So the king saw that. So he went to the other side of the river and rescued that fawn, and he just took care of the fawn like mother, father, friend, and you know. So he became so attached to the deer, he stopped his spiritual practices. And one evening, the deer didn't come back. He couldn't sleep all night long, worrying about, because he's a king, he wants to give protection. That's what kings do. So in the morning, he went searching for the deer, and he fell off a cliff. And as he was falling, he was thinking of the deer. And when he died, hitting the jagged rocks at the bottom, with his mind fixed upon the deer, Bharat became a deer, or he took the body of a deer. That's Bharat. Now I'm going back to Ajamila. Ajamila was thinking, he was attached to his son. So thinking of his son, he called his son Narayana. He wasn't thinking God, because Narayana is the name of God. He wasn't thinking, oh God, please help me. He was thinking, Narayana. Please help me. My son. But because he called the name of the Supreme Lord, in great helplessness, the agents of Narayan, they're called Vishnu Dutas, they confronted the Yamadutas and said, leave him alone. And they said, who are you? We're the agents of the Lord of Death. No one stops death. Who are you? You look very beautiful. Four arms, beautiful features. We're the agents of Yamaraj. And they said, well, we'll tell you who we are in just a minute, but if you're agents of Yamaraj, you're supposed to uphold the principles of religion. That's what Yamaraj does. So we have some questions for you. What are the principles of religion by which someone is to be punished and someone is not to be punished? There's several other questions. And so they explained when the Yamadutas, the agents of the Lord of Death, gave their answer, sounded pretty good, but they said you missed something that's very essential. One who calls the name of God, even unintentionally, admitted that Ajamila wasn't intending to call God, he was intending to call his son. But because he called those syllables, Narayana, without offense, he's cleansed of all his sinful reactions, not only for this lifetime, but millions of lifetimes, because the name of the Supreme Lord is so powerful. So, back to the Bhagavad Gita verse, Svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato bhaya. The greatest fear is going down from the human form of life to the lower forms of life. And specifically, here's the path that's followed. Before you get, you don't just go to a lower form of life. You go to the hellish planets first, a little pit stop in the hellish planets. And the way that time works, this is a little spin out, but you don't follow this, that's okay. That's not the main message. But time is relative. Right? Relativity? Einstein? So, according to the Vedic picture, time and... leave alone Brahmaloka, the topmost planet. We'll just go to the heavenly planets. Swargaloka. In the heavenly planets, one day is equal to 6 months. One night is another 6 months. So one day and night in the heavenly planets is 1 year. In lower, below the human species, just even on this planet, the whole life cycle of some insects is 48 hours. You know, they take birth, they grow, exactly as the Bhagavatam describes, the six stages. They produce byproducts, they dwindle, they vanish, and they die. And that takes 48 hours. It may be some microorganism, it's a shorter cycle of time. But that's their 100 years. And our 100 years is, you know, whatever that is compared to the... And the heavenly 100 years is compared to the... And just keep going. It's time is relative. Time is relative. So what happens, just like when you're dreaming... Do you ever dream? You have good dreams or bad dreams or both? Both, okay. You ever dream of Krishna?
When you hear your lectures.
Okay, when you hear the lectures. You dream of Krishna's pastimes? Wow, I'd like to see those dreams. One time I'll tell you about a dream I had of Krishna. So, when you're dreaming, you're just, the body's lying in the bed, and it seems like a long time is passing, but it's just short time. All these events and events and events and events and events and events. But it's because it's going on in the subtle plane, it happens, it seems like a long time, but in this plane it's a short time. So what happens is the Yamadutas come, if one has been sinful, and they use subtle ropes to take the subtle body and take the subtle body before Yamaraj. And then there's some judgment made by Yamaraj because of your sinful activities. This is your hellish planet destination. And the hellish planet, the soul is taken to that hellish planet and they experience hellish sufferings. And the hellish sufferings are so hellish that they plead, get me out of here. I'll take the body of a bumblebee or a worm or a tree or you just get me out of this suffering condition. And then, boop. So all of that takes place in a flash, an hour time, but then that's a whole lifetime. You follow? Relative time. So in one sense we can say, when the soul dies, you know this from your medical practice, coma means that when the soul dies, the soul immediately is transferred to the next situation on our plane of time. Coma means the body's not fit for habitation, but the next destination isn't determined yet. And so it's like nimbo. You're neither here nor the next place. And some people come out of comas and they continue because there, you know, it wasn't the right time for them to go to the next situation. Tell you a little story. It's a, maybe as medical practitioners, you may be interested in this. This is was told to me by our governing body commissioner in San Diego, and he has in his congregation of the San Diego Temple a nice couple, an older couple, one man who's kind of an intellectual fuddy-duddy, a little bit like that, and his wife is very devotional. He's a nice man, but, you know, kind of pedantic and not a sharp tack. He's just, you know, talks a lot and really doesn't do much kind of person. And a nice guy. So they're older, and he found that he had some kind of very serious disease. I forget what the disease was. And, you know, he was not turning to God because he was, you know, not so pious, but not so really religious. And it got worse and worse, and he was hospitalized. So our Bundri Narayan is his name. Bundri went to visit him in the hospital and said, "Mr. So-and-so, we've known each other for 40 years. You've been coming to the temple for all these years. Now this may be the end of the line. So my appeal to you, I'm able to say this because of our relationship, please just give your life to Krishna. Give your mind, give your heart, give your soul to Krishna. Try to think of Krishna in that way, just submitting yourself and surrendering to him. And maybe because of all those years of supporting your wife's devotional practices, and Krishna will take you to him." And he left. Within a couple of days, the man entered a coma, And the coma lasted, I forget the number of days, but a long time. Something like 20 days. Is that possible medically?
Yes.
Yes?
Yeah.
20 days. And relatives came from India and all over the place, and devotees were there, and, you know, friends. And one fine day, on the 20th day, his eyes opened up wide. And he sat up. And he said, "They came three times." That was his first words. And the relative said, "Yes, we've been here for a long time." He said, "No, they came three times." The nurses said, "We were here the whole time with you, all monitoring all of your, you know, symptoms." And he said, "No, they came three times." And the devotees said, "We came 10 times, just chanting and having kirtan and being with you." And he said, "No, they came three times. The ugly ones with sharp, piercing teeth and fangs and terribly looking. And they came the first time. And I said, 'No, I am with Krishna. Please go away.' And they went away. And then they came again. And I said to them again, 'No, I am with Krishna. Please don't take me. I want to be with Krishna.' And they went away. And then it happened again the third time, and then I woke up." He didn't know what it was. He wasn't a religious man that had belief in the Yamadutas and, you know, some kind of... That wasn't his nature. But because he had had svalpam apyasya dharmasya trayate mahato vayat, he had received the association of his good wife who was chanting. He would go to the temple and accompany her and kind of sit there and, you know, hear the holy name and see the deity and take prasadam. And, you know, his heart wasn't into it, but he was being benefited. Now, I've not met that man, but I'd like to. I've heard similar things from devotees in Russia. Their mother never read anything about the Yamadutas. It's just they have that experience, and etc. So the principle of spiritual buddhi yoga that Krishna is describing in the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, in principle, is very simple. Now, how to apply the principle? The principle is, with spiritual intelligence, that you use your senses. I'm doing this, this means senses. It means, you know, the hands, the ears, the eyes, your senses. There's knowledge acquiring, jnanendriyas. There's working senses, karmendriyas, and there's the mind, 11 senses total. Use them purposefully. The consciousness behind the activity is to please the master of the senses. Same activity, same occupation, same everything. Use the material intelligence. But not, you know, how to bring the senses to the sense object, for the purpose of pleasing Krishna. For the purpose of the master of the senses should be pleased. That's the principle. The difficulty in practice is we have another conditioning. The other conditioning is the material one. We want to enjoy. We want to be the enjoyers of what we survey. The field of activity. That's the conditioned tendency. That's what makes it difficult. So the principle is, one more time, with spiritual intelligence, apply myself to please the senses of the Supreme. Use my senses to serve the master of the senses. That's the spiritual position. That's chapter 2 of Bhagavad Gita, and that's the contents of the Gita summarized. So how to do that is energized or empowered or awakened by the process of shravanam kirtanam, hearing and chanting about Vishnu. Shravanam kirtanam Vishnu, hearing spiritual sound vibration. that spiritual Samvrig Shabda Brahman awakens the innate consciousness of the soul to serve the Supreme. That's our natural consciousness, a consciousness we turned our back on, or it became covered. It becomes awakened by contact with Shabda Brahman. And that's what we're the Hare Krishna movement, we're the Hare Krishnas. We didn't call ourselves that, other people call ourselves that, the Hare Krishnas. Like when I travel, I other than in China, in parts of the world where you can't be a devotee, at least outwardly, this is all I have to be everywhere I go. So people will sometimes come up and say, it just happened coming here. Are you a monk? And these days they say even more, are you a Buddhist monk? I mean, they know more about Buddhism than they know about anything else. So I say, yes, I'm a monk, but I'm a Krishna monk. And they go, oh, what's that? I said, you've heard of Hare Krishna. They go, oh, Hare Krishna. Okay, well, thank you very much. Like, shh. It was just curiosity. But just even Svalpam Apyasya Dharmasya, the message from the Ajamila story and what this verse of Bhagavad Gita is, even that little, even they don't know what it is, it's just curiosity. Chatur Vitabha Jante Mam Jana Sukritan Orjana. There are four types of pious people that begin devotional service, and sometimes it's just curiosity. Hey, what are you guys about? Okay, thanks a lot, see you later. They hear something about Krishna, and that hearing Krishna, hearing that sound vibration, Krishna, is a great benefit. I've been listening to some morning walk conversations with Srila Prabhupada in Jhulu, and he's having these very animated discussions with the devotees, and you can hear the crunching of his feet on the sand, and it's in the recording. And then some people come by, and very distinctly, right in the middle of a very intense dialogue, Prabhupada makes it very clear somebody's passing by. Hare Krishna! And that's an indelible gift to the soul. It's just little, alpam, svalpa, very tiny. But it's so powerful, spiritually powerful, that Trayate Mahato Vayam. The guarantee with even a little devotional service is the human form of life in your next life. Not the lower forms of life, at least minimally human form of life. And from there, you continue wherever you left off spiritually. It's that kind of an asset. It's a great, think of banking, and what account can you put money in and it's there in your next lifetime. There's no such account. When I was a little boy, I didn't know this. My aunt, who I met later, she opened a bank account for me in Florida. I was born in upstate New York. She opened a bank account in my name on my birthday. I didn't know it because I was, just born. But, 18 years later, here comes a notice from a bank in Florida that says, hey, you got a bank account in Florida. In your name. And it was, whatever it is. And now it's got this much interest, and what do you want to do with it? Oh, I don't need a bank account in Florida. But that's not going to be there in my next life. That's not, what bank account is that? But spiritual bank account is like that. It's a really good investment. It'll never, it's better than gold standard. It'll never diminish in value. And it'll be there life after life. And so you just space out and don't do any spiritual something for the rest of your life. Your next life is still going to be there. What to speak of if you continue and continue and continue and continue. However slowly, continue to awaken this consciousness that says, let these senses be used to serve the master of the senses. I may not even know what that means. If that desire is awakened to some degree, and I try to some degree, That's a spiritual asset that's permanent. What to speak of regular cultivation through devotional practice. So my encouragement to all of you, busy as you all are with your studies and practices of professional work, add something every day, like, where is she? Shriniti? She's a homeschool student here. She's getting small. Okay, there she is. So I asked her today, along with the curriculum that you're studying, how much time are you getting to read spiritual literature? She said, 1 hour a day. And you're 7?
10, 11.
11, excuse me. 7th grade, that's it, 7th. 7th grade. So imagine, I mean, I'm thinking, since I was in 6th grade, 7th grade, if I was reading scriptures an hour a day, an hour a day, an hour a day, an hour a day, how much chanting do you do every day? A little bit, right? A little bit, okay. It has a cumulative effect. It's a permanent, although the body is 11 and in 7th grade, it goes permanently to the soul. Permanent asset. And think of all the years, or maybe, I don't know, think of all the hours of academic study of everybody collectively in this room. It's a mountain. If some part of it was direct devotional activity, a permanent asset, collectively, individually and collectively, very powerful. So that's Krishna consciousness. And whatever capacity you have in your very busy life, add something every day, every day, every day, every day, some devotional practice every day, and it will help carry you to the ultimate destination of the soul, the awakening of that buddhi, the spiritual intelligence, how you can practically use your skills, your career, your intellect, your everything, in service to the Supreme Lord. That's what devotional practices are meant to accomplish, including studying Krishna's words in Bhagavad Gita, chanting Krishna's holy name, and attending discussions like this, taking prasadam, that's nice too. Hare Krishna. Okay, so any comments or questions?
Pardon, I have a question.
Yeah.
So you talked about a king who was thinking about a deer at the time.
Yes, Bharat, yeah.
Same time you were advising us, even a small amount of devotional service will not go to Peter, right? 100%.
Yeah.
How that works in that?
Good, that was a good question. Well, he had a special dispensation because he took the body of a deer. But because in his previous life he had engaged in devotional practice, he was given full remembrance of his life as the king in the body of a deer. Most of the time we forget, as I was explaining, because of embodiment we forget. And the very next lifetime was birth in a Brahmana family. So it was an exception to the rule in many ways. One is he didn't take again a human form of life. Another is, in a deer's body, he was given human recollection. And his next life, from a deer to a human, to a brahmana. It was an arrangement so that in that third life, after the king, the deer, and then the third life as the young brahmin, Jant Bharat, he didn't make the same mistake again. He didn't let his mind wander and desist from his spiritual practices. Good question, though. Sharp. Yes?
You said about a complete whole.
Yeah. Purna. Complete whole.
But I thought holes were empty.
You want to hear a little more about a complete whole, what that means? Okay. I'll do it in two ways. Do a material explanation and a spiritual explanation. We'll do the material explanation first. Here's one napkin. And if I took the napkin and ripped it up in little pieces, now it's little pieces, and tossed it on the middle of the floor. The original napkin is gone. There is little pieces over there, but the original one is gone. That's the material example. So that's something material, you can't break it into little pieces, and the original is still there. So the spiritual one is, the purnam, is that kind of completeness, where that which is the source of everything is complete. The completeness is so complete that although little pieces or complete expansions, you know, the napkin expands itself into another napkin, the purnam expands himself into another purnam, Krishna, who is within the heart of every living entity, he says in the 10th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, is but a portion of my plenary portion. It's just an expansion of me that's sustaining the whole universe. And the purnam from which that Lord of the Heart or the Lord of the Universe comes is the original purnam. Although he can expand, we'll say it this way. In this assembly, we did this last night also, maybe there's 40 people. So each one of us are individual souls. 40 individual souls. And within each soul, according to what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, there's a form of God within each soul. So although there's 40 individual souls, there's one supreme soul who has expanded himself equally into the hearts of each one of us. It's not 40 gods. It's one God. One purnam. But he's expanded himself in the hearts of each individual soul. And in fact, the individual souls are also another kind of expansion from him. A partial, a fragmental expansion, a complete expansion, but he remains complete. The source, purnam, is that kind of completeness. So it's different than this kind, the material kind. And that's the nature of God, all purnam. Spiritually complete, the complete whole. Yes?
Can I just ask a question about you listening to the Bhagavatam every day is recommended?
Yeah.
I was just wondering, are we to listen to the exact Sanskrit shlokas or the essence? Actually, is it just the essence or talks about the Bhagavatam or the actual shlokas?
How good are you at Sanskrit?
Okay. But I can't remember it.
Okay. I've learned Sanskrit just by hearing, but not by studying it. So my experience is what's more important than the Sanskrit sloka, although the Sanskrit sloka is certainly very attractive, is the meaning. And that's the translation of the verse, but the translation of the verse is not going to be understood minus the purport. So when you read, if you like the Sanskrit, read the Sanskrit, but essentially the meaning. So the translation and then the purport. I'll exemplify that in this way. Long ago, some 40 years ago, there was a printing press in one of our temples had, and that the person in charge of the printing press asked Srila Prabhupada, is it okay to print a pocket version of Bhagavad Gita, just the verses, carried around in your pocket at different times of day, just read the slokas, put it back in your pocket, very convenient. And Prabhupada's reply was, he was negative, and he said, there are many translations of Bhagavad Gita, and what's distinct from them is not so much the meaning of the verse, how the verse is translated, but how does it, how do you apply it? What's the commentary that's there? That's where there's difference. So without the commentary, you're not going to understand Bhagavad Gita. Benjamin Franklin, nice American, wrote when he was a teenager, "My friend and I read the Bible day and night, and he reads black and I read white." Meaning, we all have our different interpretations and renderings of what it says. So the commentary is essential, as well as the translation. But somebody that's had some experience with learning Sanskrit, the poetry of the Bhagavatam, the alankar, the alliteration, and it's so beautiful. So, just beautiful. And therefore, Srimad Bhagavatam. For those of us that don't have that good fortune of having learned Sanskrit and pronunciation and so on, reading the verse in the purport is very nice. Sufficient. And the other just adds to the pleasure of reading. And I find it also helps the message go in. Appreciation of the Sanskrit. Something else? Yes.
I just like homeschooling because I learned a lot.
You learned a lot. What did you learn? Tell me something that you learned.
I learned the 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita.
You did?
Yes, because my mom, she used to teach me Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah.
And the other stuff.
How much do you read from the scriptures, of the spiritual teachings? Do we have a little competition here? How old are you?
Nine.
You're nine. And you're homeschooled, right?
Yes.
And do you read from the spiritual writings every day?
Not
really. Okay.
Yeah.
A little bit.
About every day.
About.
What was that?
About every day.
About every day. Okay. Maybe next year. When's your birthday?
April 24th.
Okay, well, in September, when you start, you know, the next academic year, maybe you can have a little increase in how much you read the spiritual writings. Because then you're going to be, you know, when you're older in school, at least school-wise. That will stick with you. You may not remember all the academic stuff, but that's going to stay with you. Okay? Very good.
Okay. I have a question.
You do?
Maharaj, I want to give you one scenario, actually, the practical scenario which we like. So we wake up at 6 and we reach at in our office or clinic at 8. So we work continuously till 6 o'clock. We have half an hour of lunch break, and then we come back, we are totally stressed out physically, mentally, and then we are very hungry also at that time, so we take some food, and then suddenly we have an urge for sense gratification, like maybe watching a movie or watching something which give you a little bit of sense gratification. So we do that, and then we start feeling sleepy, and then by the time 10 or 11 we sleep and then wake up again 6. So in this kind of robotic lifestyle, how do you think we can use our sense gratification in service of Lord Krishna?
How do you use sense gratification in service to Lord Krishna?
Sorry, how we can use senses for...
Oh, okay.
In service of Lord Krishna.
Well, I, at the end of what I spoke this evening, I made a little appeal, and that is, you can start incrementally, start with something that's doable every day. Best is in the morning, every day. And if for some reason it doesn't work out in the morning, I mean, the reason it wouldn't work in the morning is depends what time you go to bed at night, so you just can adjust, go to bed a little earlier, get up a little earlier. That's kind of pretty simple math. But every morning, ideally, something that involves hearing, like, you know, reading Bhagavad Gita, chanting, spiritual sound vibration, maha mantra, ideal. And just do that a little bit every day. A little bit every day. What will happen? Purification will come about. And as purification comes about, that little bit starts to grow. A little bit becomes a little bit. If you do it regularly, it will grow. And in course of time, depends on one's degree of spiritual commitment, but as that grows, what happens is you become not only purified, but you become spiritually empowered, so that the attraction for sense gratificatory things fades, and instead the attraction for spiritual activity, like instead of watching a movie because I'm just fatigued, you something else, something that has a spiritual dimension to it. Where I'm staying at the Houston Temple, downstairs is Vatsal. And Vatsal has to maintain his family. So he doesn't have this kind of education you have. So he's one of the things that he does is he drives a truck. And he leaves the house at 5:15. And he's back in the afternoon. When I, you know, pass by his door, he's in his living room playing harmonium and singing Hare Krishna. I imagine he did some japa before he left, and he took rest early, got up early, chanted his japa early. I imagine he's listening to something while he's working, driving, and as soon as he's home, he's, you know, it's devotional fun rather than the other kind. So it's senses in the service, but it to the master of the senses, but it comes about naturally. It grows from within, and then different propensities come out. So it's, where it starts is something that's regular. Something that's doable, you can do it every day. And the best of all things is chanting Maha Mantra, and following that, reading from scripture. Another very, very important thing that doesn't take much time is it's related to controlling the tongue. That is, before you, when you prepare your food, you offer it to Krishna and take Krishna prasadam. Time-wise, it doesn't take that much time, but consciousness-wise, it's very important because the tongue is an end for service to Krishna. But I'm hungry, so I take the food that I'm preparing, offer it to Krishna. And then you start to, you know, think of other things, that when I go to the marketplace, let me buy not just the best things because I want my pocketbook to be full, but the best for Krishna, because it's for Krishna. And I buy it in that consciousness, and bring it back and clean it in that consciousness, prepare it in that consciousness, offer it in that consciousness. It changes one's consciousness. The senses being engaged in the tongue by vibrating and tasting, those are good beginnings. And do them regularly, and they'll Krishna consciousness will awaken, the material attraction slackens, and in its place comes spiritual activity. Different persons will find likings in different spiritual activity. Some in deity worship, some in reading, some in chanting, different things, writing, different things. Devotional, connecting your consciousness to the Supreme, yeah.
Maharaj, Bhagavad Srimad Bhagavad Gita also talks a lot about karma.
Yeah.
So, according to you, I just wish an opinion, what should be given more priority? Karma or devotion to God or saying name of God? For example, a practical scenario.
What if I said both?
Yeah, exactly, both. But if given a case, for example, on a birthday, you plan to go to temple and offer offerings to God, Another thing that you can do is go on a birthday and offer food to the orphanage. What should be given priority based on it?
The consciousness behind the activity is what's the essence. So if my consciousness is, let me do this for the pleasure of Krishna, then then you could be n number of things for the pleasure of Krishna. Here's the problem. We don't have that consciousness so strongly. Therefore, sadhana or practice to bring my consciousness to Krishna is needed. Krishna is everywhere. Krishna is not only in the orphanage and not only in the temple. Krishna is everywhere. So in one sense, I don't need to go anywhere. But whatever it is that can help bring my consciousness to Krishna, that's the best birthday activity. And for most of us, the devotional practices help us the most bring our consciousness to Krishna.
But doesn't that giving to the orphanage bring an indirect offering to Krishna?
Depends on the consciousness. Back to the starting point. Depends on the consciousness. So so here's you get some of the range. On this end is I do it because I know it's pious activity. And pious activity will benefit the other person because it's an orphanage. And it will benefit me because it's pious activity. And with that comes bondage. To receive the good karma, there's bondage of the good karma. I'm binding myself to the material nature. That's on that end. Then way over on the other end is Yad Karoshi, Yad Asnasi, Yad Jahosi, Dada. Whatever I do that for Krishna. So, going to the orphanage, going to the temple, going to see my friend. I'm not going to do something that's gross violation of Dharma. But if I do that, I want to do it in full Krishna consciousness. And if I do the other thing, full Krishna consciousness. The other thing, full Krishna. Full consciousness of Krishna. That's on the other end. Now, where are we? We're not in that with the mind always fixed upon Krishna consciousness. That's not where we are, at least most of us. So, for the benefit of the soul, best is I direct my consciousness to the Supreme, to Krishna. Now, out of all the possible things I could do on my birthday, what's going to be most effective to achieve that? Then it's no longer karma. Then it's an expression of devotion. But I need to awaken my devotion before I can act in devotion. If I can do that activity in full consciousness of Krishna. It's not that pious works, pile up a whole bunch of pious works, and you're going to reach Vaikuntha. Piety doesn't create spirituality. So if it's just that raw kind of a choice, then it's activity of devotion is the best. But doing some beneficial work in Krishna consciousness can be fully spiritual. As spiritual as going to the temple. But it depends on the consciousness. Yes?
Is it in the same context?
Same context, same example. Birthday?
Yeah.
What am I going to do? Okay.
What if you see somebody on the road who is dying? Would you rather help him or go to the temple? I mean, within the same context.
I know what I would do. I'm not a physician.
Yeah, even I want to help the person.
I would stop my trip to the temple and make an arrangement to have a physician, somebody qualified, because I'm not qualified, take care of the situation. And I would stay until the ambulance came. I would, then I would go to the temple. That's what I would do. here's some service that Krishna is providing me in my way to the temple. And I would do that service to Krishna. But I'm not a physician. I can't, you know, fix their problem. And turn it the other way around. What if I was that person, you know, with a medical problem, and somebody's on their way to the temple? Hey, man, you know, please help me. Okay, sure. I'll stop my trip to the temple and help you. Sure. But we would want that. And I would want to do that, to help somebody. But in the consciousness of, this is a service that Krishna is giving me the opportunity to render on my way to the temple. Yes?
Follow up on Chandra's question. So if we are going through the daily grind, doing everything, and we are putting so much effort, and there's just somewhere Gita talks about staying detached.
Staying about what?
Staying detached from whatever things we're doing for the purpose of thinking about the fruits of the work.
Staying detached.
Detached. I thought you said tax. I couldn't figure it out. Paying the tax. What are you talking about? Staying detached. Okay.
If we do go through the daily grind, we put 100% effort, how does one stay detached?
By giving everything to Krishna. Krishna, please accept this offering.
And you still...
It works. You know how you get that consciousness? Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama. By 5th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, what is called renunciation, detachment, is the same as yoga, or linking oneself with the Supreme. So detachment is a fruit of linking oneself with the Supreme. And how do I link one? It starts with karma yoga. The fruit goes to Krishna. But even beyond karma yoga, it's not just the fruit goes to Krishna, but I go to Krishna, my consciousness goes to Krishna, my everything goes to Krishna. And when everything goes to Krishna, the results are up to Him. I'm giving it my all. And I'm speaking in a very realistic way. I work very hard.
I have no doubts about that.
And in working very hard, seriously, you know, the detachment comes by doing that for Krishna. And sometimes things go this way. And sometimes things go that way. That's completely up to Krishna. It's like this question of, you see somebody on the side of the road. Here's some opportunity to serve Krishna. Here's another opportunity to serve Krishna. Here's another opportunity to serve Krishna. And life is, but it's just constant flow of opportunity to serve Krishna. And I find myself, if you don't call it a grind, I find myself very enthusiastically, all day long, non-stop. It's ecstatic, because it's service to Krishna. And at the end of the day, I'm not feeling like you described. Oh, I'm exhausted, I've got to turn on the television and make my brain numb for a while. It's, you know, hear a lecture by Srila Prabhupada, or chant some more japa, or some other form of service, some deity worship, something that's, hear a story from Mahabharata and Ramayana and Bhagavatam, and like, and, you know, like that. It's ever fresh. You're next. She's next. Go ahead.
Okay, so from my understanding of what you said, I'm not sure this is right, so I'm asking you.
Okay.
So whatever you do, you have to do it in service for Krishna.
Yay! Very good. Keep going.
So, like, for example, I don't work because I'm only 12.
Oh.
But
you go to school.
Yeah. I go to school for Krishna, so I can get the education,
and
so I can do proper service for Krishna.
Yeah. You got it. Good for Krishna. Now, there's other people, lots of other people, they have a whole other idea. I'm going to school because I like to compete. And I don't like to lose, so I got to win. So it's competition. And competition for what? Recognition, that's one thing. And so that I can get into a good school, that's another thing. So they can get a good job, So that's another thing. So I can have lots of stuff, and I can be a happy adult. And that's why, that's the carrot I'm chasing. That's why I go to school. Go with it. And then the other is devotional. I'm here because I'm Krishna's part and parcel, and I want to serve Krishna. And during this stage of life, it's something that I'm preparing myself so I can serve Krishna in a very wonderful way. The faculties of intelligence and ability and skill, and I want to take all the nourishment I can to develop those things so I can serve Krishna very nicely. Yay!
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, we got one over here.
You said if
Krishna takes your offerings, what if he doesn't accept your offerings? Whoa. I've never had anybody ask that. He's not obliged. What you're saying is true. Krishna doesn't have to. But here's the good news. If you offer something with love, Krishna will accept because he's loving. So here we have this example of someone that's going to school, cultivating, let me do this for Krishna. Krishna's loving. He'll accept that offering. He'll not only, Prabhupada gave this expression, if you take one step towards Krishna, he takes 10 steps towards you. He wants your love more than you want him to accept your love. 10 times more. Because that's the essence of what Krishna is accepting. It's not the thing that you're offering. It's the love that you're offering. Let me tell you a little anecdotal story. I was visiting a place one time when I came on an international flight and I landed it. You know, something. It was an all-night thing. And we landed and, I didn't know up from down. You know that feeling. So I got to the place where I was going, and it was like 5 o'clock in the morning. And it was time for the morning, Mangal Arati and then class and stuff. So I went upstairs to take a shower, try to become, right side up a little bit, and, put on my tilak and put on my dhoti and get ready to go downstairs to attend the program. In the place where I was, there was a young girl, maybe, 7, 8 years old, and she had made a gift for me. It was string of garlands, or necklaces for a deity, that I don't have a deity. But she was so enthusiastic. I was still putting on my dhoti, and she just came right in to give me this little gift. I said, okay, thank you very much. And looked inside, and it was unmatching colored beads, different sizes, different colors, a whole bunch of them. Now, let me ask you, what do you think I felt? I'm asking you. What do you think I felt? This rude little girl, I don't even have my dhoti on and she's coming right into the room. Or was I thinking, what a wonderful gift of love. She couldn't wait to offer this gift. To this day, I remember it. Because it was offered with love. So if you offer something to Krishna with love, don't worry. He'll accept it. Best if you make an offering of something that you know Krishna likes. But even if it's not something, just like there are different versions of the Mahabharata where Krishna went to Akura's home to have his meal, and his wife was so excited. She served the banana peels instead of bananas. And Krishna ate the banana peels. There's another version that says it was porridge. At least that's the British version. Porridge means some not very, fancy food. Like khichdi or something, just like a little mix of this and that, and put in some water and boil it. Porridge. That's the British version. But because it was offered with such love, Krishna accepted it. He was so happy. Yes? Or Draupadi's pot, the little piece of spinach that was inside the pot. You know that one? Because of the love of Draupadi, Krishna was so pleased. You offer something with love. That's the main concern. That's the main concern. Whatever it is, offer it with love. It can be the simplest thing, or the most elegant thing, or somewhere in between. Offer it with love. Krishna will accept. Right? Okay, confirmed. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada. Good thing it's Friday night, because it's late.
So Maharaj, I would, actually I really want to tell two things actually.
Two things.
I know we're running out, so.
I want to say a third thing, that you've done your two things.
Okay. So one other thing actually, we have always been asked this question about the social service and a devotee going to temple.
Okay.
But I'm not able to understand, like if you are a devotee, then you're all automatically you're good at heart, you have compassion for other people. So, and if you're good at heart, you feel pain for other people, you would definitely help that person. So I think it's all interrelated, like it cannot be other way around. Like,
well, but there's a big difference between the mode of goodness and devotional service. It's the difference between heaven and Vaikuntha. One is binding and the other is karma-free. So good at heart can mean mode of goodness. Good at heart can mean transcendental consciousness. And it's a big difference. What's the other question? You forgot.
Yes. I want to actually mention one of the pastime I had with Radha Vallabh Prabhuji.
A pastime with Radha Vallabh.
So it was 2 years ago, I still remember 2 years ago, he actually do Sunday cooking in the morning, so we were helping out with something else and we were talking to each other, and he told me that, you know, I used to listen Bollywood music, like we have a lot of Bollywood collection, when he was not a devotee or when he was becoming a devotee.
You told the story, you weren't supposed to tell this.
So he said that now I don't like it anymore. I said, why you don't like it? He told me a very important principle, and I'm very thankful to him that he mentioned that principle to me, that when you acquire the higher taste, you don't care for the lower taste. So once you acquire the spiritual taste, you don't like the material.
It fades. It just goes away.
So
very good.
Yeah, so that's what I learned from Radha Vallabh Prabhuji. I'm very thankful to Radha Vallabh Prabhuji.
Okay, here's what I just looked at my watch and saw what time it is.
Thanks.
And I would like to stay with you, but I'd also like to get back and get up early and chant my japa in the morning, because it's a long day tomorrow.
Yes,
so, and I know that would disappoint you.
No.